Just Curious.
Welcome to Just Curious Media. This is Into the Mystic, and I'm Jason Connell. So this is very exciting because this is a brand new show from Just Curious Media, partnered with the Mystic Film Festival. That's right, in Mystic, Connecticut, founded by Shireen Anderson, and it's going into its sixth year later this fall. Super exciting. I found out about this festival a couple of years ago. I went and saw a classic movie screening because they do a lot of indies, obviously, and they sometimes sprinkle in some classics. And I saw Desperately Seeking Susan, and director Susan Seidelman was there, spoke with her, tons of fun. So upon moving to Rhode Island last year, I was like, oh yeah, what's Mystic Film Festival up to? Well, they were up to their fifth year, and I joined them. I helped them with logistics and running the volunteers, and also emceed awards night. I thought it was a great way to get to know people in the area, get more involved in the community, the arts. I'm very close to Mystic. It's only like a 35, 40 minute drive. And so it was so much fun. And I really wanted to see if we could work together even more. And here we are launching the Into the Mystic podcast. So on this first episode, I have a wonderful conversation with well-known actor Karen Allen. And you may know that name because she's in movies like Animal House, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Starman, Scrooged, and so many more. She's also in the brand new Indiana Jones movie coming out this month, The Dial of Destiny. So she never stops, and she gave us so much of her time. I thought we might talk for like 30 minutes, 40 minutes. No, we went well over an hour. And we even had our call broken up because she had something else scheduled. So we reconvened, but you cannot tell. It's seamless, folks. In fact, we were going to do Zoom and there was some Wi-Fi issues. So we went straight phone call, old school. So her audio isn't quite as clear. The cell phone's really good at times, less good at others, but she's great nonetheless. And we talk about, you know, her impressive film roles, her non-movie ventures, as well as her directing debut of a short film, which there's a big event this week at the United Theater in Westerly. So much to listen to, enjoy. And again, this is episode one of hopefully many, many more to come. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Karen Allen. Karen, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
You're on the first episode ever of the Into the Mystic podcast.
All right. And by the way, Into the Mystic is my favorite song ever written.
By Van Morrison.
Yes.
It is so
good. Fantastic song. Yeah.
Yes, we're definitely bringing that into play with that title. We love that as well. And just to be clear, this is created by and for the Mystic Film Festival. And I recently got involved. It's coming up on its sixth year this year. I got involved last year. And Karen, you were going to be at the festival. You were going to be at awards night, but tell us what happened.
Oh, I had an issue. It's kind of ongoing, but I had an issue with one of my ankles and feet, which I had kind of twisted. And it had gotten so bad that I could barely stand. So I'd gotten up, I'd gotten dressed, and I had to pull myself together to get out of the house and drive myself to Mystic, which was about 2 hours away or so. And I just thought, wait a minute, this is crazy. What am I doing? I'm going to get there and I'm going to have to walk on this foot. And it's just, I'm really going to be causing myself a lot of problems. So I had to cancel literally at the last moment. And, you know, it's turned out to, I've had kind of an ongoing issue with it now. It's still recovering. And that was in October.
Oh, so my gosh.
I know. But it's much better now than it was.
But, Good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I just knew I was there. I actually was hosting the awards night. And it's like, oh, no, Karen Allen, she's a scratch. She can't make it. She hurt her ankle. We're all like, oh, my gosh. We should have got like video or something or you on Zoom. But you must have been in a lot of pain. And so I'm very sorry to hear that.
Later, I was in the midst of doing a whole bunch of film festivals throughout that whole period of time. And I ended up for about three or four of the festivals having to wear like a, you know, this kind of medical boot on my foot in order to be able to travel and walk around and do anything. But at the time, I didn't even know what a medical boot was. So I was just sort of out. It was just killing me and I couldn't figure out what to do. But anyway, yeah. But I'm coming to Mystic now.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. We'll get into that. That's exciting. We definitely want to get into that. But what you missed, and I'm sure you heard, was a movie that you were in, a beautiful independent movie named A Stage of Twilight, written and directed by Sarah T. Schwab, co-starred William Sadler, who's also incredible. I met both of them, by the way. But it won Best Narrative Feature at the Mystic Film Festival. And it played very well. Everyone loved it. I was truly moved. So you were there. You were representing yourself even not there because the movie, you know, was such a, you know, piece of you. And that was wonderful. So you've already kind of graced Mystic's presence with your movie. And so I'll save for a little bit later what's coming up, what's in the works, because there's other big news. You're doing, like, I'm sure, junkets all the time. You're going to Los Angeles soon. Because on June 30th, 2023, 42 years after the original, is coming Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, where you reprise your role of Marion for the third time. Is this exciting or what?
Well, yes, of course, it's exciting. And it may be the last of this particular series.
Right.
And I can't talk a lot about it.
Of course.
Because, you know, since we shot my role in it, I have been forbidden to let anyone know I was in the film. And now that it has premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, I guess the cat is out of the bag, so to speak. And
correct.
So now I'm allowed to talk about the fact that I'm in it, but of course, under pain of death, nobody wants any of us to talk about the story or how I'm in it or any of those things. So mum is still the word a little bit, but I am going to go to the premiere in Los Angeles. Oh. So, yeah.
That's exciting. Well, is this where you hurt your foot initially? Is that what happened?
Oh, when I was working on the film?
Yeah.
Okay. Something very mundane. I was literally like just racing down a flight of stairs and I just twisted it.
Okay.
And there may have been some, you know, what do they call them? Stress fractures involved as well. But whatever it was, that has, anyway, nobody wants to hear about this. It's boring.
That's okay. Well, I won't pry the fact that you're in the movie. I knew. I looked up a few months ago and you weren't even on there. So bam, you're right. It premieres.
Oh, I know. They're keeping it so quiet. I think now I'm on IMDb.
Yes, that's exactly true.
Yeah.
That's how I found out.
They didn't have my name on the first poster they released.
Yeah.
There's been all this cloak and dagger stuff. That's what they wanted to do. So
it's very exciting.
Trying to be cooperative. But it's been a real pain in the butt, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, people have been so angry and upset thinking I wasn't in it. And I have to stand there and go, yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's really tough. Or they interview you, like, want to know about your role and you can't tell them anything. So, well, I'm not here to pry. I just thought it was great that you're in it again, reprising your role. And yes, it's probably.
Yeah, you'll see.
So that's the movie around the corner, the big Hollywood movie coming out this summer. But let's go back in time, Karen. Let's go back to like your first movie. Like, I was looking at your IMDb credits because I've followed your career for so long, but I had a list of movies. And let me just knock these out and then we'll kind of dive into some, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Starting with National Lampoon's Animal House, then Manhattan, The Wanderers, Cruising, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Starman, Scrooged, Malcolm X, The Sandlot, The Perfect Storm, In the Bedroom, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So that's just some. That's just 12 titles in just a huge list of credits. But it all goes back to the first one. And that's one of my favorite movies. I've actually gotten to know the director, John Landis. I honored him at one of my film festivals. But that's your first movie. It's just like, you know, classic. You're playing Katie. Like, let's go back there. Like, how did you land that role? And did you even think that you were making something that would hold up for decades to come?
Well, you just don't know any of those things. But I had been a theater actress in Washington, D.C. for 4 years working with a theater company. And I had come to New York, although I had lived in New York previously. I'd gone to school there. And I came back to live in New York to work in the theater. And I was studying at the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute because I had had a kind of eccentric training with an experimental company. And I just wanted to see how other people had been trained. And I was walking through their lobby one day. I'd been in New York maybe 3 months. And I just glanced up at the bulletin board. And there was a 3x5 card that said feature film casting college age actors and actresses, send picture and resume to. And I was 26 at the time, but I looked young and I thought, I think I could play a college student. So I just wrote down the address. And when I got back to my apartment, I just, you know, sent off a very eccentric picture and resume because I didn't really know how to put together a picture and resume. And it was all from theater performances. That's all I had on my resume, too, was just theater stuff. And I got a phone call, and they said, we'd love to meet you. And they gave me an address. And when I arrived there, it was Universal Studios on Park Avenue in New York. And I went up, and as I came into the little area, you know, where the offices were, this woman came walking boldly across the room and said, I know you're not in the union. I know you don't have an agent, but you're coming in to meet John Landis with me because you're my girl. And she kind of patted me on the shoulder.
Huh.
And I was like, really? Like, I just had no idea, you know, anything could be that easy. And she took me in and I sat down and Harold Ramis was there and John Landis was there. And I think Chris Miller was there. Doug Kinney may have been there. I sat at this table and just chatted with them for a while. And they were very jolly and fun. And I had a lovely conversation with them for 10 or 15 minutes. And I left and they said they would like me to come back and read some scenes from the film. And I said, sure. So they gave me some what are called sides.
Right.
And I went home and I took a look at them. And I came back a few days later and I read with Harold Ramis. And then they had me come back, I think, a third time. And I think I may have read again. And then they said they wanted me to fly to Los Angeles. And they wanted me to read in front of the Universal guys. And so they put me on a plane and I flew out there. And Peter Riegert had, in the interim, been cast to play the part of Boone. Yeah. So he was there to read with me. And I did what I thought was a terrible audition because I think I was nervous. And I, you know, there were just all these guys in suits sitting there. And what I didn't know at the time is none of them wanted to cast me in the role of Katie because I had no camera experience. And I guess there was another actress who had a lot of experience in television and they were all much more keen for her, but she couldn't somehow do the scene where when Katie storms out of the house in the very beginning of the film and has that scene with Boone where she says, oh yeah, great, you and your friends coming up to my parents' cabin and emptying their liquor cabinet. For some reason, every time she was doing that scene in the audition, she was crying. And like, honestly, it didn't occur to me. And John Landis kept saying to her, no, 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 it's a comedy. Like Katie wouldn't cry when she says this. And then they'd have her do it again and she would cry again.
Wow.
And so I kind of got the role by default because she couldn't do, sure, she wouldn't or couldn't or whatever, do the scene without crying. And it never would have crossed my mind to cry in that scene.
Yeah.
And so they cast me. And I don't know how long later, a few weeks later, was off to Oregon to start to work on the film. But no, I had never, you said, you know, did it occur to me that it was going to be successful? I knew nothing. I mean, I loved films. I had been a student of films, you know, watching films and stuff, but I knew nothing about the film business. I think when I met with them for Katie, I had never met a single person in my entire life who had worked on a film, ever. So, you know, not only had I never been on a set, I'd never even known anybody who'd been on a set. So, wow. I didn't really know how to read a screenplay. I read it. I don't know that I really felt like I understood it. It takes a while to understand. I'm a huge reader, and I've read hundreds of plays at that point in my life, but screenplays are a kind of unique animal. So I was just scratching the surface of knowing how to read and picture how I might translate a screenplay into something I'm seeing in my own head.
Yeah. Well, you embodied the role, so we're all better off that you got it. I don't know who the other actress was. We don't have to mention names. But yeah, I always thought, wow, you're like fresh face, girl next door. You were just so good in that role. I would never have thought it was your first movie. Of course, I saw it before I even knew it, you know, knew that there was actually a business behind making movies. But then your first director is John Landis. So it's like, and by the way, you work with some bigs, Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg a few times, John Carpenter, Richard Donner, Spike Lee. Like, I put you up there with anybody as far as pedigree of directors you've worked with. It's really unbelievable.
Paul Newman.
William Friedkin, Todd Field. So it's just like, oh my gosh, look at this.
Wolfgang Peterson.
Yeah, Perfect Storm. It's like you have been blessed in that regard. But you're seeing that first movie, and some of the actors in that movie went on to be huge. But you have that experience. It's not out yet. So are you then leaving that going, I want to do this. I want to make more movies.
No, I was really very much a theater person.
Okay.
And I was there in New York with the idea that I was going to work in the theater. And it turned out it was a lot harder to get cast in a role in the theater than it was to get cast in a role in film somehow.
Interesting.
In theater, they want a real pedigree, you know, because they want to know for sure that you're going to be able to do it. I mean, there's no cut in the theater.
Right.
When that curtain opens, you got to deliver the goods.
Yeah.
So I found it much harder to get a role as an actor in the theater than I did to be cast in films. And certainly being cast in Animal House opened a lot of doors for all of us. So once Animal House came out, that next year was a little bit of a weird year because I had done the film.
Yeah.
But the film wasn't out, and so I was in a bit of limbo. But once the film opened, all of a sudden, everybody wanted to meet me, and a lot of the other actors in the film as well. You know, we suddenly all were launched into... Because most of the actors in the film, like me, had never been in a film before.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we were, for some reason, they chose a lot of theater actors to play these roles.
Yeah, and John Belushi. Which didn't.
And John Belushi.
So then I was watching Manhattan the other day, revisiting it like I do, because I have other podcast talks about movies. And I'm like, that was Karen Allen in there. And it was like a bit little scene. You're a television
actor.
Little teeny,
tiny
but I
kid,
spotted you, man. So like, what was that? Was that just a little thing? Like, hey, come on. I mean, it's an iconic movie, of course. But
well, I went in to meet him for the, is it Margot? Margot Hemingway,
yes.
As the young girl. But I was really too old at the time. I mean, I was 26 or 27.
Right.
And even though I looked young, he was really looking for somebody who was
like 16, 17.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I met Woody for that role. And then he, I guess, just liked me, even though he didn't think I was right for that. Although he never offered me anything down the line, but he just asked if I would do this little role with David Rashi, and I'm not going to remember the name of the other actor, unfortunately. I remember David's name because I just still, you know, I know him,
we're
friends, but I've never seen the other actor since. But Woody Allen came down, he said, okay, here's the thing. You're just going to improvise. I am up in this booth and I'm a writer and I'm writing for a kind of like a Saturday Night Live type of television show. And I'm complaining about how much I hate it and how horrible the writing is. And I want the three of you to make up a scene. And then people came and they just dumped a bunch of costumes and things, wigs and costumes on the floor. And we were down there for a couple of hours just playing around. And I don't know. I don't even know how it evolved, but we came up with this silly idea, and I was going to play this catatonic woman, and one of them was playing a real close friend of who? Jimmy Carter's or somebody. I can't remember even what the scene is now, but anyway, we lit it up. He came down. He liked what we had done, and he shot it.
I love it. Yeah, it was great. It was like, oh my God, there she is. But it, I didn't know if it was a bigger role or not, but at least
he put you in it.
It's a classic. Again, you have a way of finding yourself and winding up in these amazing movies. And then you have The Wanderers and Cruising, but I'll skip ahead to a huge staple along the way was Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I'm sure Animal House put a spotlight on you. Spielberg knew you, but how did you get in that role? Because that was, yeah, it's before it was huge, but Spielberg had already had a name. Things had been percolating.
Right.
So how did that come about?
Steven was good friends with John Landis at the time.
Right.
He was good friends with Phil Kaufman, who was actually one of the writers on Indiana Jones. And I had just worked with Phil Kaufman
during
The Wanderers, which is Richard Price's novel. And then I had done another film called A Small Circle of Friends that Rob Cohen's very first film. And Rob Cohen and Stephen were friends. So I think somehow my name had come up and Stephen had said, you know, did you like working with her? What was she like? And they were all very positive. They'd all had a good experience working with me. So when he was coming to New York to meet people for Raiders of the Lost Ark, he asked that I come meet him. And I went in and just sat down. And I don't even remember who else was in the room, but there were two or three people in the room. And he and I just, we chatted for about 15 minutes. And he didn't tell me much about the film at all. But he, I think, sort of indicated it was kind of a tough character. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I heard back and they wanted me to fly to Los Angeles and do a screen test. And they sent me the scene at the bar when you first meet me, when Indiana Jones comes in. And so I learned that scene and I ended up flying out with John Shea, who was a New York actor who was gonna audition for Indy. And then while I was there, I also auditioned with Tim Matheson, who they brought in to audition for Indy because Tom Selleck had been cast and then couldn't do it because of Magnum PI. And they didn't have an Indy at that point. And I auditioned with the two of them. I did two different screen tests with the two of them. And then they cast me in the role. And there still was no Indy. And they were scanning about looking for an Indiana Jones. And somewhere along the line, I think, you know, they had just felt like they couldn't find the right person. And it I don't think that it hadn't occurred to them that Harrison might be the right person. It was just that he was already too deep in the Star Wars
Han Solo,
trilogy.
Yeah.
And I think they maybe thought, you know, it could be a conflict to have him in both. But in the end, I just remember one day they just announced, you know, it's going to be Harrison.
Wow.
So that was great. And yeah, so that's how I ended up in that. You know, it's all interesting, kind of a little quirky. Who knows?
In a few years, though, you go from your first movie to now you're in another huge film. So now are you thinking, this is it? This is my life. This is what I'll be doing. Or are you still thinking, I got to get back to theater or something?
No, you know, after Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, I took 2.5 years off and just did plays. I did two plays. I did a play that went to Broadway, but it went to, you know, it was at the Kennedy Center and things like that before. But it was a new play. I worked on it with Arthur. Arthur Penn directed it. So he's no slacker. And with Arthur Penn and William Gibson, Jane Alexander played opposite me. So it was a really, really wonderful, wonderful experience. It's really just a profoundly wonderful experience. I played a character who was deaf and blind.
Oh, wow.
So that was a huge acting challenge.
Yeah.
And then when that was over, I did another play, which I had seen done at the Louisville Theater, what do they call it? Louisville Theater Festival, I guess, which was an extraordinary play. And I hadn't been able to do it initially because I was still in the Monday After the Miracle. And Susan Sarandon took the role and she opened it in New York. And then after about 3 or 4 months, she was ready to move on. And I went in and took her place in that play and stayed in that play for about 6 months. And I was really happy to do that. Everybody in the film business thought I was nuts. My agent, fortunately, was a wonderful, supportive person, and she wanted me to do whatever made me happy. So,
oh, that's great.
But a lot of people thought, what are you doing? You were just in these just huge films.
Raiders is like, huge.
Why are you not capitalizing on that? And I thought, well, you know what? I am kind of capitalizing on it. I'm just capitalizing on it in my own way. You know, I'm using having done those films to be able to do what I would like to do next, you know. So for me, it made sense. And for a lot of other people, they didn't get it. But that was okay.
Well, what offers were coming at you when you were in the middle of those plays?
I got offered a lot of stuff. I did get offered a lot of things. But you know, once you commit to a play, you're committed to a play,
right.
You know. Yeah, I'm not going to drop out of a play to do a film. At that point, it just wouldn't have occurred to me.
Well, 3 years later, you do show up in a very memorable movie I love, Starman, directed by John Carpenter. You played Jenny Hayden. What a beautiful film and a great reason to come back and make another great hit, I think, with
Well,
Jeff
I did
Bridges.
A film before that. I did a film called Until September
Paris,
which I absolutely adored doing. And with the wonderful French comedian, Thierry Lhermitte. And Richard Marquand, the wonderful Richard Marquand, who passed away sadly a few years later at way too young an age, but he directed it and was just a delightful person to work with. And then they asked me to do Starman with John Carpenter, and that was really, really fun too. I mean, who doesn't love working with Jeff? He's like the sweetest person on the planet.
That's such a great film. It really is remarkable. And Carpenter shows his chops from all the horror movies to this beautiful movie. Yes, it's sci-fi, absolutely, but it's really character-driven. And just, in fact, I need to revisit it. It's been like a good 5, 6, 7 years since I've seen it, but I've always loved it. Stood out. And they made a TV show. You know, they did a lot of spinoffs and things, but it was great to see you in that. And I'm just hitting some beats. You have done movies nonstop. I had to just stop myself and just pick out some gems that I like to go revisit a lot. But then they're Scrooged, 1988, Claire Phillips, Richard Donner, another legend. But this movie doesn't even get older. It just ages beautifully. In fact, I showed my girlfriend the movie this last Christmas because somehow she'd never seen it. And I'm like, here it is. It still works. And there's Karen Allen. So, I mean, what an incredible experience. This had to be fun to make because it just works so well.
Yeah, it was fun to make. Bill was it could be a bit challenging to work with.
I've read.
There were times where I was sort of secretly planning a ski accident where I wouldn't have to continue making the film. But then, you know, things kind of, you know, got a little easier.
Oh, that's great.
But we had great times working together. And then there were times where it was just so challenging.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the film has had this sort of amazing long life, and it's now become a kind of Christmas classic.
Totally.
It's the sort of, you know, there's all the schmaltzy, sentimental, many of those films I love to pieces, so I don't mean it in a negative way,
but
I mean, it's a film that just sort of kind of sends up all of that in a delicious way.
Yeah, it's a wonderful take on the old tale, and Bill Murray's great, and I've definitely heard this from people in person and read this about his challenges, and he kind of takes over a set. But he's left us some good films, and he's still making films, but just to cast you in that was perfect. What was Richard Donner like?
Richard was worried the whole time Bill was going to fire him. I mean, you know, Bill was firing people to the left and to the right. And Bill fired Connie... that extraordinary, extraordinary cinematographer. I'm blanking on his Conrad Hall. Conrad Hall was our cinematographer.
Oh my gosh.
Excuse me. I think a weekend Bill had him fired because he saw some dailies and didn't like the way he looked or something. And a wonderful cinema. Michael Chapman came to shoot, and I'd worked with him before, and he's a lovely
person. Amazing. I've met him.
Wonderful.
Rest in peace. Incredible, incredible person, incredible cinematographer. Yes. That's incredible. So I knew he did it, but I didn't know the other story. But I've always loved Donner films. I mean, these guys, and mainly guys I'm mentioning, the directors you've worked with, they all have a style such their own, like a Donner film, a Wolfgang Peterson film. So you were just around these, an embarrassment of riches of these just heavy hitter, legendary directors. I know I said it before, but I shake my head at it. I mean, you're in Spike Lee's Malcolm X, and maybe not a huge role, but you're in it as Miss Dunn. It's just like, oh my gosh, not only you're in these movies, you're choosing great roles, Karen, which is awesome. So that's a credit to you and your agent, but most people don't have this type of pedigree.
Well, I don't know. I don't really go around thinking about it very much. But,
well, keep doing what you're doing. So then you make a movie that has also held up from my teenage years, but I'm sure it's still speaking to younger audiences each and every decade, and that is The Sandlot.
You know, I didn't even know that that film had become the huge hit it became.
Huge.
It's so funny. My son was maybe a year old when I went off to do that film, and he came with me, and he's just a baby. And because I had this little baby, you know, they wanted to put all of my scenes together so that I could shoot them. So I was there, and I was maybe on that set for, I don't know, 10 days, if that.
Wow.
And we just shot all my stuff all together so I could take my little boy and go home. And
yeah.
And then when it was going to have its premiere, my son was only like 2.5 or something. And I brought him to the premiere. For some reason, we were in Los Angeles. I don't know why, but I brought him to a premiere in Los Angeles. And within 15 minutes, he was hysterical. He was like, the whole thing behind the thing, he got scared.
Of, oh, yeah.
Before
you
even
beast.
See the dog.
Yeah.
He was scared to death of the beast. And he started crying in the middle of the premiere. And I had to like take him out and just kind of go home. So I didn't even get to see it initially. And then I did see it at some point later down the line. And I thought, what a charming film.
Yeah.
But then flash forward 20 years or something, and all these people of a certain age started coming up to me and telling me it was the film of their childhood.
Yep.
And on and on and on and on. And from my perspective, it sort of kind of came and went. It was a sweet little film, but it came and went. But, you know, that's not really accurate. It became this sort of major film, you know,
that's true.
To this day, I think people are, you know, it has these anniversaries and stuff, and all the kids, you know, they get together, and it's kind of an amazing film, I guess. In that landscape of, had my son been a few years older, I might have been much more connected to that film. But he was too young when it came out. So
does he like it now?
I don't know if he's ever even seen it. I don't, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure if he's ever seen it.
How funny. How funny.
Yeah.
And ironically, you're the mother in that film. So there's that.
I know. I think that might have been my first mother. I have to think about it, but it might have been the first mother I ever played. Yeah.
Well, and then I'll skip further ahead into the 2000s. You come out of the gate, 2000, Wolfgang Petersen, The Perfect Storm, playing Melissa Brown. And this movie is just riveting. It's so good on so many levels. Also shot in New England, I believe. And
well, I shot all my stuff in Los Angeles on the Warner Brothers lot.
Okay.
Because our stuff was all in the largest
tank
in the world. And it was the hardest film I've ever had to do my life. Oh, my God. I mean, my life was in danger several times when we were shooting it. And I was so exhausted during that film because we would be in this tank and it had, I don't know how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of gallons of water were in this, but they couldn't really keep them warm. And they could bring the wind up to 100 miles an hour in this tank. They could bring there were wave machines on all four sides of the tank. And then they have this thing called a dump machine, which would pull up something like 4,000 gallons of water and dump it down into the tank all at once to create these big waves that were cresting across the boat. It was, and then the boat itself was screwed onto this thing called a gable that was being mechanically manipulated to make the boat really be in the high seas. And it was very challenging on all of us. I mean, I would go home. I would like crawl home after a day's work and I'd be asleep at like 6 o'clock at night or something.
And you have to act. You're not only terrified, you have to perform in this environment. Yeah, that is grueling. Well, the final product is fantastic. I don't know if you feel same. I don't know if you're a fan.
You know, I haven't seen it in years, but I remember thinking it was really it's a heartbreaking story.
Yes.
It was the first time, I think, too, that I stepped into this kind of high-tech world, the cameras were all on these techno cranes and Wolfgang and all of the crew was back, like very far away from the set, kind of calling on a speaker out to us. You know, we'd be down in this water and they'd whip up all these special effects and we'd be like feeling like we were drowning. I mean, you get a wind going 100 miles an hour and the water in the air. And even if your head is above water, every time you take a breath in, you just get water in your nose and lungs.
And they're just like, act.
We'd be in there, and I'd look over at Bob Gutton, and Bob Gutton would look truly frightened to death. And Cherry Jones, we'd be kind of looking at each other, and then Wolfgang would go, action, and he'd go, you're scared. And we'd be like,
I got that.
That's not working without any work at all.
Jeez, that I'm terrified just hearing about it. Oh my God. Wow.
Oh dear.
Then there was another movie right after this, equally terrifying, but for very different reasons. And I think it's such a beautiful film. And I was recently up in the city this was the backdrop of, was Camden, Maine, and that is In the Bedroom. Todd Field's masterpiece.
Yeah.
And you play Marley Keyes. And I'm watching that movie. I revisited it because I did an On Location episode last year. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. Karen Allen's in this movie. And you know what I always thought? I want to see more of you. You kind of pop in the courtroom. And like, I always thought, is there more scenes that we didn't see of you? Because
no, I'll tell you this. Okay, I'll tell you the story about that. So I went in to meet Todd and he was in negotiations already with Sissy Spacek, but at the moment when I was meeting Todd, he thought it wasn't going to work with Sissy, that it was whatever they were haggling over or whatever the thing was. He wanted to meet me on the chance that Sissy Spacek, it wasn't going to work out for her to do it.
Okay.
So I went in to meet him. We sat for 45 minutes just chatting away and having just the grand time. And I said, well, look, he sent me the script. I'd read the script. I said, I would love to do this. And if it doesn't work out with Sissy, who I knew a little bit, I said, if it don't work out with her, I'd love to do it. And I said, and if it does work out with her, if there's any other role in this that I could do just to be a part of this film, because I think it's wonderful, let me know. So about 3 weeks later, I guess it had worked out with her, which disappointed me because I would have loved to do that role.
Yeah.
But he got in touch and he said, you know, it's not much, but there is this role of the attorney who is the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, we just need you for a day or two up in Camden. Would you consider doing that? And I said, sure. I said, sure. I'd love to come and do it. I just wanted to work with him. I thought it'd be fun to see Sissy again, who I had met but didn't really know. So I just went up there and shot it in a couple of days. I mean, it might have even been a day. I probably came up there, did costumes, you know, stuff, and then shot. Yeah, I think it's just that one scene. No, there's nothing that was cut.
Well, that makes
what you see is
so
what we shot.
Much sense, Karen. Thanks for filling, because I always thought, she's so great. I want more. And that makes total sense that you are potentially going to be the mother. And Sissy Spacek did it. That makes more sense to me because, I thought, well, there's got to be more because she's so amazing. Like, they're meeting with her at a restaurant.
I would never have said yes to a one scene part in the film.
Right.
Because the thinking on that often is that you shouldn't do that. If you're somebody who's thought of as a leading lady or whatever, you shouldn't accept cameos. But I've never kind of gone by those rules anyway. I just feel like, you know, we should be free to do whatever we want to do. Like, everything is not a career, you know.
I agree with you.
And, milestone.
And you made that movie better. And what an amazing thing for you to be part of such a great movie. So it all worked out. In fact, you know, me wanting to see more of you, all your fans, that's a good thing. So I was like pleasantly surprised. It was great casting across the board. And I do think it's a wonderful film that I like to watch every so often. It's heavy. It's a hard watch. It's very emotional.
You know, I think I saw it once when it came out and I don't think I've seen it again.
Gosh.
It doesn't, I mean, it doesn't appear. I don't see it coming up on things. You'd have to really look for it.
Oh, you have to buy it. Yeah, I usually, yeah. You have to own it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I may own it somewhere. I just, you know, I have like so many DVDs, and like everybody else, I've just turned into a streamer.
You're a streamer.
Girl, yeah. You know. Yeah.
I bought it on Apple. So now my movies are on Apple. I was like, oh, when I went to Camden, it was really surreal going there. And this is years later, of course. But it was like, wow, this is a perfect backdrop for the movie. And the last movie I have on my kind of hit list before we get to other matters is the second time you reprised your role as Marion Ravenwood in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And that was, of course, 2008. So was that interesting to, I don't know if you'd ever reprised a role before in a movie. Was that the first time you'd done such a thing?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever. Yeah, it was. It was.
Was that exciting? I mean, that was still Spielberg at the helm. And it's not the most popular of the Indiana Jones movies, but it was still cool to see them bring it back because it had been idle for so long. But was that a great experience or fun? Or
it was a great experience. And I think it's a kind of a misunderstood film. I think that what Spielberg and Lucas and everybody was working on it, what they really were trying to do was create an homage to the 50s.
Right.
And they brought in the sci-fi element, and they brought in a lot of filmic elements, you know, like Shia pulling up on that motorcycle in a very, looking very Marlon Brando kind of, you know, using. They were playing around with 50s genre. You know, it was like a 50s music and the whole thing that they do in the beginning with the cars, you know, and all of that. And I think they thought it was all in good fun. And for some reason, it seemed like, you know, whatever the fans or whatever the critics or who, you never, how do you ever know? Like, you know, I think that they thought it would be seen for what it was and appreciated and enjoyed. And instead, there was a little blowback from it. Although it seems like it, you know, it certainly did well out in the world. It certainly brought a lot of people into the theaters. But you're right, in the grand scheme of things, it isn't people's favorite, but then are any of the sequels people's favorites? You know, I think, as happens, the original film, it's very, other than The Godfather, maybe.
Yeah, I know, right?
You have to try to come up with sequel where
Terminator
people thought
2,
it was as good as.
People like a lot. But yeah, besides Godfather 2, it's tough. And actually, the second Indiana Jones is a lot of fun. Temple of Doom is well-regarded, and Last Crusade is as well. And people hold those things sacred. So no matter what, there may have been blowback. You're right. It was probably misunderstood. But it did lead to Dial of Destiny. If there is no Crystal Skull, maybe there's not this newer one. So it connected it, and it didn't make it too foreign. Because it would have been weird to come out of nowhere 2023 after Last Crusade. So I think it maybe served its purpose for, you know, Harrison to continue the character. And so, yeah, I didn't love it, but I probably went in with higher expectations. I've not revisited The Kingdom of Crystal Skull. So I probably need to. After this call, I'm going to do that, Karen. I'm going to revisit it and have a whole new perspective and do a whole episode on it.
I have a whole new perspective on it. But, you know, if you look at it, I think in a more lighthearted way, although, you know, all of them have lighthearted aspects to them. But I think one of the things that may have been a detriment is Stephen really wanted it to be sort of in the style of the earlier films.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to use CGI, although there is a tiny bit in it. But, I mean, he wanted it to be, you know, when that film was made, we were in the land of CGI. And they certainly could have gone in that direction, as you will see when you see this new one. They certainly went in that direction wholeheartedly.
Fair enough.
But I think Stephen very much felt like in the feeling or in the mold of Raiders of the Lost Ark, he wanted to keep things as real and as authentic as possible. So there weren't these outrageous stunts. You know, I'm one of these people who generally is bored to tears with CGI.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, there's no jeopardy, there's no nothing.
I totally
see
agree.
The CGI. I sit there and go, what time is it? Can I leave now?
Yeah.
I'm just like, it doesn't engage me. Yeah. And I doubt that that is Spielberg's perception, because he has done films that have a lot of CGI in it. He just was trying to keep it in the same spirit.
Yeah.
And so maybe there was some disappointment there that he could have gone further in that direction because it was available at the time for him to use it in a more major way than he was willing to do. I don't know.
But nonetheless, Marion was in it, and we were all happy for that. And your character lives on, and I cannot wait for this summer, the blockbuster. Super exciting. But we won't talk about it, because I know you're sworn to secrecy.
Well, I can't talk
not
about
yet.
Anything specific.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's been written about my role in it. I haven't really looked at any. Have you looked at the
I
things
have not.
That came out of the
I like to be surprised.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right. Well, I like to prepare people to be disappointed if they think they're going to see me in the film, because it's just, I think people are going to be watching the film and go, wait a minute, I thought she was in the movie.
Well, I hope that you're tied up and you're gagged as you are in the other two Indiana Jones movies.
No.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I'll still go see it. Well, now we can segue into something else. So thank you for going down memory lane with me. I mean, we could have broken down each one of those movies in their own episode, so maybe that's for another time. But I kind of want to hit a few things before we get to a really timely topic, which I know is very close to your heart. But as we get into that, just some personal tidbits I learned about you through IMDb, and I just wanted to bring them up here and maybe talk about them first.
So much of what's on that is incorrect.
Okay. You can set the record straight then. So did you found Berkshire Mountain Yoga in Massachusetts in 1995?
I did.
And that's amazing. So you're a big, you're a yogi.
I was a yoga practitioner from the time I was 19. So that would have been like in the early 70s. Yeah.
You were ahead of the whole curve. You were like an early adopter to yoga here.
I was. I lived in the West Indies, and there were people who were practicing Ashtanga yoga down there. And it was the first time I had really ever seen, I'd seen yoga practice, but I've never seen people doing Ashtanga, and I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Wow.
So I was a hatha practitioner for many years, but then I became a serious Ashtanga practitioner, and I opened the school when I moved up here. I moved up here when my son was 3 or 4, because I had to put him in school, and I didn't want to put him in school in New York, really. So we came up here and I put him in school in the countryside, which was just great. But then I suddenly thought, wait a minute, what am I going to do up here? You know, I was just trying to figure out what made sense. And I just looked around and I thought, how could I make a contribution to this little community? And there really wasn't a yoga school here at the time. So I found a space and I too long a story to go into, but I had a little money that had come my way from some not great thing, you know, where I'd had a script sort of taken away from me at some point, and they had to pay me some money. And I had been so upset about it, I just threw this money in an account, and I thought, I'll do something good with this at some point.
Wow.
And so I used it to build a yoga school. I mean, it was in a building, but we did a big, wonderful renovation of the top floor of an old barn. And I ran it myself for 5 years, which was very, very fulfilling. And then I handed it off to one of my students who I had trained because I moved back to New York, and she took over and ran it for another 5 years. And then I held on to the building for a while, and it stayed a yoga school until about 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with it in its last incarnations, except that I rented the space to the people that were there.
Dare I ask if that script ever became a movie?
Yes, it did, as a matter of fact, but I'd rather not talk
Fair
about
enough.
It.
Fair enough. Let's not talk. I don't want to dredge up those memories. So let's not talk about it, okay? Sorry I asked. Okay, you can just dispel this myth or tell me it's true. Did you create the Karen Allen Fiber Arts in November of 2004?
Yes, and it still exists, and I'm in a space right above. So it's a store.
Okay.
And a studio. It was a studio first. So I decided to leave New York City again after moving back there in around 2004 after 9/11. And,
yeah.
You know, it was like there were just all kinds of issues. And it was hard for me to really figure out how to raise my son, have him in a school in New York, which was expensive. He studied two musical instruments, which was really expensive. And I couldn't really work very much, certainly couldn't travel without pulling him out of school, which sure. I didn't want to do. So we moved back up here. And again, I went into this thing of like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And what I had studied in school when I first went to school in New York City was design. I'd studied textile and clothing design. And then I had not really followed through with getting a job in that world. But I always knew someday I would use those skills in that particular interest. This goes back to my childhood.
Sure.
So I was a textile maniac. Like I just loved textiles when I was a kid. And I had a grandmother who was very oriented in that direction, who I adored. So I always knew I was going to do something. And so when I was still in New York, I went back to FIT, which is the Fashion Institute of Technology, if you don't know. And I just studied Japanese knitting machines, which, you know, it takes a couple of years of operating them. They're hand manipulated, and it's a real skill. And
wow.
Now I've been working on them for about 25 years. So I bought a few and brought them up here, and I put them in a little building down the road from my house. And I just spent all day while my son was in school seeing if I could figure out a way to create something I thought was unique and beautiful and make a line of knitwear on these. And I chose to work in cashmere yarns, which I thought were really beautiful. And I thought I can do something that nobody else is doing with this. And I took the machines, and once I got comfortable on them, I started to work on them in a very unorthodox way. And I started getting these effects from working on them that nobody had ever seen before. And that was kind of thrilling to me. And then I just kept going. And what's nice about it is actors, it's such a collaborative endeavor, as are being a director. It's very collaborative, but it's wonderful to have something that you're doing in your life that isn't a collaboration.
Yes,
and
exactly.
I really felt a need to have something like that in my life, and it turned out to be a very wonderful and positive thing. So I made my first line, knitwear line, about 2 years after I moved back to Massachusetts, and I put it into an art gallery, and people were just amazed by it. You know, like everything sold, and then I just felt very encouraged. And then there was a little tiny space in Great Barrington that was for rent, and I rented it. It was maybe 600 square feet or something, and I started a little store there so I could have a place to put these things. And then I started going into the clothing shows in New York. There were a lot of designers, because I'm a textile-oriented person.
Yeah, maniac,
there were a lot of designers. Yeah, maniac. Okay, I'll go with maniac. There were a lot of what I was aware of, a lot of small studio designers who were doing really extraordinary things, textile-oriented things. And I went and found a lot of them, and I bought things and brought them to my store. So it became a store that kind of celebrated very unusual things that people were doing in small studios, like not mass produced things, like
right.
one of a kind things, a
yeah.
lot of them. And it just, you know, it's never really made much money, but I have a wonderful team of people, three women who work at the store, and I just adore them. And one of them has been with me for the whole 18 years. And we just keep trudging along, and it gives me the freedom to, when I get a project to work on, I go away and do it, and I come back, and the store kind of moves along without me, and then I am in and out of the studio whenever I have a chance to do that. And yeah, it's been a very, very positive, upbeat, lovely thing
oh,
in my life.
So great.
Yeah, most actors, need something like this.
Yeah.
Because when, you know, everybody goes through periods where they're hot and there's lots of projects coming
yep.
their way. And then people go through periods, doesn't matter who you are. I mean, some of the most well-known, celebrated actors go through fallow periods where they're
oh,
just
yeah.
sitting around waiting for the right thing. And if you don't have some other thing that you love doing, you get caught in the horrible trap of taking jobs that you really shouldn't be doing, like stupid shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, they do it. You're right. Nick Cage can't say no to anything. You're absolutely right. Well, I'm looking at your website now, and these, I mean, the hats, the shawls, the scarves are so colorful and beautiful and vibrant. Really amazing stuff.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's very positive. It's like this organic shop. It just works without you. It works with you. You are the catalyst. And yeah, you got to have outlets. Absolutely. And this is such a positive one. So yeah, if you're in the neighborhood, Massachusetts, check it out. You got to swing by. It's an actual store. Karen Allen Fiber Arts. Yeah, so I learned this yesterday. I was like, this is incredible. Well, then I learned something else. Which, you, again, tell me if it's fact or fiction, but
okay.
You're a good harmonica player.
I'm a little out of practice these days, but I used to be a really good harmonica player.
Well, that's incredible.
I've always loved the blues.
Yeah.
I forget who turned me on to the blues, but, you know, if you grew up in the 60s, you got exposed to a lot of really, really, really
yeah.
great music, and a lot of it was rhythm and blues.
Maybe John Landis influenced you. Otis Day and
no,
Nights.
I was
no.
way into
okay,
it back
way before,
then.
Way before.
It predates John Landis, but I have my collection of harmonicas and stuff, and
wow.
on a rare occasion, I will pull them out and play a little. But it used to be a much more part of my world. I think in New York and certainly in Washington D.C., I used to hang out with a lot of musicians, and they were always wanting me to play harmonica with them, and so I got to do that. And I used to love to, you know, I used to be, you know, somebody who just loved to sing as well. But these are all things that you can't be a dilettante, you know.
Yeah.
If you're gonna do them,
you gotta,
you know, you gotta do them.
Do you still make it to the stage? I know that acting in front of a live audience was a huge thing. Are you still doing that actively?
I'm doing a beautiful play in a just we go into rehearsal in about 6 weeks.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's wonderful. Well,
yeah.
Not to bury the lead here for the festival, and this is an event on the horizon, but you, at some point in time in 2017 or probably before that, you had the urge to direct. I mean, you'd worked with these iconic directors, as I've talked about. So what led you to direct A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud in 2017? A short film, a beautiful short film.
I didn't really have the urge to direct a film. I had
okay.
been directing already in the theater for about 12 years or so, and I was really enjoying that. And people would say to me from time to time, when are you going to direct a film? When are you going to direct a film? And I'd say, I'm not. I said, look, you know, I've spent most of my life on film sets. There's no part of me that doesn't understand how complex and difficult and challenging it is
yeah.
to direct a film. And I don't really feel I need to do that, was my feeling at the time. And a producer who was at the Mystic Film Festival, I'm sure with Stage of Twilight, he had produced a play I was in New York. He had also produced a play that I directed in New York. And he kept saying to me, I think you should direct a film. I think you should direct a film. And I kept saying, oh, you know, I would give him all the reasons why I didn't think it was a good idea. And he would come back and say, well, if you were going to direct it, and I would say to him, look, having never directed a film, I have worked with way too many filmmakers who are doing their first film, and I've worked with,
yeah.
you know, probably 12 first-time filmmakers. And I said, I watch how they get that deer in the headlights look, you know, of like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? And most of them have never done a short film. They're like signing on to do a feature film.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, have they lost their minds? Like, what are they? So I said, if I'm going to do this, I would do a short film first. And I would do a short film that was very simple, that didn't have a lot of moving pieces, you know, not a lot of locations, not a lot of actors, not a lot of whatever, you know, just simple and tell a really simple, pure story. And he said, okay, that sounds great. So what would you do if you were, he kept saying, what would you do if you were going to do a short film, what would you do? And I said, well, there's this story of Carson McCullers I have loved my whole life. It's the most beautiful, delicate little Buddhist story. And I've always wanted to do something with it. I've always wanted, I kept thinking I would adapt it for the stage and do it on the stage with another short play. And so he said, can I read it? And I said, sure. I got him a copy of it. He read it and he said, oh, I think you should do this. And I said, well, oddly enough, there is this place I drive by every time I go to the airport, and it looks exactly like the place I imagine this story taking place in. And he said, well, let's go see it, you know, drive me over there to see it. I said, well, I've never been inside of it, but the outside looks exactly like that. And I said, if we go in and it looks the way I imagine it looking inside, then all hope is lost. Then I'll have to do this. And he was like, we were laughing about it. And sure enough, we went over there and it looked exactly the way I imagined this looking. Gosh. So the story takes place in 1947, and the building was built in something like 1940, and everything was exactly where it should be. The bar was exactly where it should be. The booths were exactly where they should be. Everything, I mean, I brought on an incredible production designer who did fantastic work, who's one of my best friends, by the way. But anyway, we just started moving towards it. And then, of course, there was the horrible thing of trying to raise the money to do it. And to try and raise the money to do a short film, it's, boy, is that a ridiculous task.
Yeah, you're
it's
not like, going to you get know, your money back, but you can help. Yeah, I know. It's a,
yeah,
it's
but
a
you
one.
Can donate some
can
money
donate.
To let me make this short film. Well, we got really lucky because it turned out just by pure chance that it was Carson McCullers' 100th anniversary, 100 years since she'd been born. And the Carson McCullers Center down in Columbus, Georgia, Brian got in touch with them and found out that they were doing this huge celebration. And they wanted to give us money to do the film. So they gave it, they didn't pay for it all.
Right.
But we were able to get people to invest in it. But Carson McCullers, they came along at a crucial moment.
Yeah.
And pushed us over the line. And then it became getting it done. So the first screening of the film, there were 1,200 people that saw it.
Wow.
In Columbus, Georgia, at Columbus University, which is Carson's home.
Oh,
and I stayed
gosh.
In the house that she had grown up in while I was there, which was fantastic. And I hired two of my favorite actors, who were both of whom I had worked with in the theater, Jeff DeMunn and James McMenamin, to be in the film, which I was so happy to get them. And then we found this beautiful, beautiful young boy who was just 12 at the time. We did a major search for a 12-year-old who could play this role, and we found him, and he was incredible. Have you seen the film?
Yes, it's now on Tubi TV.
Yeah, it's on a whole bunch of things, yeah.
So I was watching it yesterday, and but yes, it is beautiful, beautifully shot, beautifully acted. DeMunn is one of my favorite actors, so
great. Yeah, he's great.
Mike,
mine too.
But yeah, what amazing things. So I'm glad your friend pushed you, the producer pushed you, because what an experience that you got from all these tie-ins. It was like serendipitous for you to make this film on countless levels.
It was. And, you know, it turned out to be a very satisfying experience on many, many levels.
Yeah.
However, when you direct a film and when you create a film, bring it into existence, it took, I would say, for the most part, 3 years of my life to raise the money to do that film, to go into pre-production, to cast it, to find the locations and do what needed to be done, ready the locations, to then we shot it, then we had to edit the color, you know, the whole, it's a whole process.
Then you go to festivals
and then
all of
it. Yeah, then when it was finished, we got accepted in festivals all over the world.
Yep.
So we went to most of them. We took it to the Cannes Film Festival. We won, our first festival was in Manchester, England, and we won Best International Film. So we had a really good experience with it. And I felt sort of like, okay, I can do that. You know, I was just not daunted by it. But like I am in the theater, it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, I'm not really a director for hire. I'm a kind of director who, if there's a play or a story that when I read it and I just can't shake it and I'm just dying to tell that story, that's what tells me I'm moving in the right direction. So Batting Cages, that to me, I directed that as a play about 12 years ago or something. And then I'm going to direct it again as a play in about 6 months. And then we're trying to set it up as a film that we would shoot. It takes place in St. Augustine, Florida. So this will be my first feature, which, you know, there's always a bit of trepidation, a bit of excitement, a bit of everything. You know, it's a lot of work. So if you're going to do it, if you're going to pursue it, it has to be with something that you're absolutely crazy about, because otherwise you can't get through 3 years of nonstop hard work with a half-baked idea.
No. It's a disservice to the project. My first documentary that I produced, directed, and I thought, I'll go in this 6 months maybe. And then it was 3 years, like you said, three years from head to toe. I learned everything. I wound up doing 9 more, but you have to commit. I had to love the subject matter, because you're going to go on this mission and there's going to be a lot of obstacles to overcome through this whole thing. And you come out the other side. So I love how you take that on as well. Like, you got to be real picky about what you do. So
you don't want to get in the middle of a huge commitment like that and be sorry that you said yes to it.
No.
That's a disaster.
So I hadn't talked much about Batting Cage. I learned a little bit about it yesterday. I was talking to Shireen from the Mystic Film Festival. Shout out to Shireen. But I was learning, like, this is a project kind of in pre-production for you to make it a feature. So I don't even know the story. If you want to give a little backdrop, I love the title, Batting Cage, but it could be a lot of things. So you want to give us a synopsis?
Well, it's a play. It started as a play. She's writing the screenplay right now. And it's about two sisters who have not seen each other for several years. They had a profound loss in their life, which was their third sister, who was the twin of one of the two of them.
Okay.
And of course, growing up as three sisters and you have a set of twins and the other sister is always going to be a bit of a third wheel.
Right.
So there was a real abyss, you know, that existed, because the one sister had a certain level of profound loss and the other sister had her own level of loss, but she was also going through a divorce at the time. And so a kind of gap this huge abyss has opened between them, but they come together and they're going to meet their mother as well in this place where they used to vacation as children and adolescents in St. Augustine at the beach. And they're going to throw the sister's ashes into the water of this beach and do a little celebration of the sister's life, which they have not really done.
Wow.
And the two sisters end up there together waiting for the mother, who gets delayed. And this whole thing has brought up a lot of grief in both of them again, to having lost the sister. But they're kind of dealing with it in an individual way, and it still is sort of this abyss between them. And it's a very, very funny play, which it doesn't necessarily sound funny as I'm describing it.
Right.
But this writer is so extraordinary, and she's written really a comedy about healing and loss. And there's a lot of poignant moments in it as well, but it's a very, very funny, beautiful, well written. The sisters are very different in their personalities and don't really necessarily understand or appreciate each other. So a lot of it has to do with their uniqueness and their inability to really kind of understand where the other one is coming from. And it's very relatable and very beautifully drawn by this playwright. She has one other film that was made from a play of hers called Off the Map, which is Sam Elliott and Joan Allen starred in it. And it's just a gorgeous, again, it takes place in the desert. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, if you get a chance to see it, it's fantastic.
Great actors.
It came out maybe 15 years ago or so. But yeah, so that is the hope, is that I think Brian Long, who is the producer that ties all of these things together, he thought it might be, I guess when he was at the Mystic Film Festival, he met some people who were interested in maybe getting involved in helping to finance batting cage. And then he thought, well, you know, maybe what we'd do is he would show to Like a Cloud and I would come and we would talk and he would introduce me to some people and that maybe we could be working towards trying to raise the money to do this because we'd like to shoot it in like the spring of 2025 is the thought. So, yeah, if we're going to do that.
That sounds incredible. Okay. Thanks for sharing. I knew nothing about it. I was riveted as you described this to me, the heaviness, the weight of it. I can see this unfolding. I have one question for you, or two questions. One is, what's the age difference between the twins and the other sister, and who's older? I just...
Like four or five years.
Are the twins older or not?
No, the twins are younger.
That's what I thought. I just was kind of imagining that dynamic. And then secondly, say it's a go picture. Here we got the funding. We're moving forward. Who do you see in your perfect world playing these two roles?
Well, I don't really, I would hate to actually talk about that. That stuff is so delicate because sometimes you can't get who you want. And it's not wonderful for actors to know that they were the second or third or fourth choice or something. So I don't,
But would you be in the movie? Would you cast yourself?
No, I won't be in it.
Okay,
no,
okay.
I don't really believe in the thing of
Self-directing,
I think that's ridiculous.
Okay.
I mean, some people seem
no
to be
offense
able
for
to
those
do
who
it,
do
but
it, but
I am not that arrogant.
Well, I think this sounds amazing. I am just like moved by your description. So let's go back to something you touched on was the Mystic Film Festival and screening A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud, because there is a screening coming up Saturday, June 24th, 2023 at 4:00 at a beautiful venue, the United Theater, which is in Westerly, Rhode Island. It's absolutely stunning, gorgeous. And you're going to be there for an in-person conversation after the screening or before, I'm not sure. You'll be there. And then after it all wraps up, there's an informal wine reception in the gallery with food provided by the Cooked Goose, a well-known restaurant in Westerly. I love the title, love the name. And tickets are available at unitedtheater.org. I was just checking this out, like, well, this is a wonderful event. I mean, you're getting back out there, you're exposing an audience to a short film they probably haven't seen. You're there, which is a big coup. Like, oh my gosh, you're scaring out. And not to mention, Indiana Jones is back on the radar. It's like, this is a perfect storm, no pun intended there.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, you know, we'll be there just a few days before it starts to open. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's super exciting. If I'm in town, I'm going to be over there. That's only like a 20-minute drive for me. Meet in person.
Okay.
And this is really fantastic. I'm super excited.
Good.
I love this. And when you start to put things out there in the creative space like we do, it starts to manifest. So I could see The Batting Cage becoming a movie. Production 2025, fingers crossed. But it's super exciting, Karen.
Well, good, 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 good. Well, I hope you can come and we can say hello, and that would be great.
Well, anything else you want to end this epic and first episode of Into the Mystic podcast? This has been so much fun. Anything else for our listeners, our fans? Any parting words?
Gosh, I don't think so. I think we've covered an awful lot of territory here. I'm a little bit like I can't really think of anything else to add except, you know, maybe some of the films that we skipped that I think people might really love, but maybe they don't know about, like Year by the Sea, which we shot up on the Cape, which is not far from you, which is based on Joan Anderson's book. And then this film, Colwell, which is a little indie film that I did with Tom Quinn, the director, a few years ago, and it got nominated for a Spirit Award. And it's just a beautiful film if anybody's just, you know, looking around for films to see. I mean, one of the things that makes me a little sad sometimes is some of my favorite films that I've ever worked on are the smaller films, you know, more like the indie films.
Yeah.
And they're just not films. I mean, people sometimes say, gee, I haven't seen you in a film for a while. And I'll think, gosh, I did four films in the last 3 years or something.
Yeah.
And they've been out there and they're getting a lot of attention in that indie film festival way, but they're not getting the kind of attention that films Well, these days, of course, almost nothing goes to the theaters except the big
Top
Marvel
Gun.
Films and things like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I actually love to talk about the smaller films sometimes because I feel like that people need to, you need to be able to know about them so that you can find them on the streaming sites and
Absolutely.
See them.
Remember, fans, A Stage of Twilight, a more recent film that Karen was in. So absolutely check that one out.
Yeah, that's not on any
not yet,
stuff
but
yet.
But
yeah.
If and
yeah.
when, yeah, that's
yeah,
the smaller movies. It's
yeah.
beautiful film.
Yeah.
This has been such an honor, really. Thank you, Karen,
thank
for
you.
Sharing your time. More time than we even anticipated. There's even more to uncover. Maybe we'll have you back again if you want to come back on. But thank you so very much, and good luck at the screening. Good luck with Batting Cage and the plays you're doing and everything else that you're swept up in. It's really impressive.
Thank you. Thanks.
So thank you so much for listening, and please be sure to subscribe to the Into the Mystic podcast. You can also really help us by giving this show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast. We also highly recommend checking out mysticfilmfestival.com as well as justcuriousmedia.com.